The Sunstone Foundation presents Mormon Theater in the 80s, Exit Stage Left, recorded live at the 1985 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 21st through the 24th. We take you to the Westin Hotel, Utah, in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Welcome, you hardy people who managed to arrive here on time, to the 1985 Sunstone Theological Symposium. You've probably all heard about the ground rules about not recording and so forth. It's my pleasure to introduce Mr. James Arrington. Unfortunately, I was not able to get much of the biographical material until a few minutes ago. For those of you in the area, and increasingly more widespread areas, Mr. Arrington is well known for his production, writing, directing, and performing of Here's Brother Brigham and the Farley Family Reunion. Mr. Arrington is a noted son of noted father and likes to surround himself with gifted people. As I understand, his wife Lisa is a very gifted musician. Mr. Arrington may want to expand on his relatively recent, or so I understand, incursion into the New York theatrical scene. I'm very personally pleased at the coming forth of this paper, because Mormon theater, we normally don't like to talk about the conflict of which drama is largely made. And without further ado, I'll turn the time over to Mr. Arrington.
This is going to be a good deal more formal than I had thought, since they are recording this, and it seems like I want it to be very fancy. Usually I get around and can front and dance around the podium a little bit, but I'm grateful to be here, and I'm especially grateful that you guys, whoever you folks are willing to get up. Normal actors and theater people don't even get up until about 9:30, 10 o'clock. The fact that you're here at 8:30, it speaks well of you, so either that or you aren't really theater people, you're here for a little entertainment, in which fact you may be in the wrong place, but I'm happy to be here and talk about this subject. I think that by the very fact that there are few people here, it shows A, that it's early in the morning, but B, it is an exact illustration of the problem we are having in the 80s in the theater. We have, I think maybe the first thing to do is probably to tell you what I mean by Mormon theater in the 80s. Mormon theater, to me, means theater that is written for and generally by Mormon people to Mormon people. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that we don't preclude things like Promise Valley, that wasn't necessarily, that was written for Mormon people, but not only for Mormon people, but can play well to other groups of people, or plays that have Mormon themes that are written by non-Mormon people. But generally, when we talk about Mormon theater, we are generally talking about people who write plays for Mormon people, and that, in the broadest sense, is called ethnic art, which is fine. There are black plays, and there are Jewish plays, and there are New York plays, and there are plays for every tiny group of people. Whenever there is a group gathered together, why, and they're willing to pay to see some entertainment, why, generally there will be a little theater piece spring up to meet the need. And that is exactly what happened in terms of Mormonism. And I would like to begin by giving you a quote from President Kimball that I think is very interesting. This was given to the BYU faculty in 1967. President Kimball said, "The full story of Mormonism has never yet been written nor spoken. It remains for inspired hearts and talented fingers yet to reveal themselves. They must be faithful, inspired, active church members to give life and feeling and true perspective to a subject so worthy. Such masterpieces should run for months in every movie center, cover every part of the globe in the tongues of the people, written by great artists and purified by the best critics." Well, that's pretty high expectations, actually. And almost every person I know in the theater who is a Mormon holds that up to high regard and says, why not? And goes after it. In fact, I hardly know anyone in either the movie business or the theatrical business who is a Mormon that does not have the best interests of building the kingdom in the church through their art in some degree. In fact, most of the people who are seeking and striving to be professionals give that as the reason that they are in the theater. Not because they love it, and not because they hope to make a lot of money, and not because they want to be famous, but because they really want to build the kingdom. And they are basically idealistic, naive, innocent, talented people who are going to do their best to build up the kingdom with the talents that they have been given. Now, that is not a very easy prospect, because most people don't give a darn about the kingdom, and especially producers and directors who don't hire people in terms of their innocence and their kindliness and their good, reasonable idealism, but in terms of their talent and what they are willing to do and what kind of box office they make. And we haven't had anybody really get up there in quite a long time. Now, based on that quote from President Kimball, I am now going to give you what I call my thumbnail sketch of theater history in the Mormon Church. Early on, it appears that Joseph Smith, although it's very hard to tell because he didn't really have a lot of time to himself to sit down and relax, he thought dramatically. And he lived in a dramatic time, heaven knows. And not only that, but that's one of the periods in which we try to write most of our plays because the drama is inherent. But in terms of temple presentation, for instance, there is drama in that, albeit in a pageant sort of way. And we don't really know much more about Joseph Smith's feeling about drama except for that. Then we came down to Brigham Young, whose feelings about theater are well known, well documented. Of course, he came into the city, and as soon as he possibly could, right after starting the temple, he immediately built a theater and started producing plays. And it was the finest theater west of the Mississippi. And many of the great artists of Brigham Young's day came here and played, and they used the backup of Mormon actors and artists to work with, and they were generally favorable about the talents and the workings of the people here. Some of them groused a little about the inconvenience of not being able to chew tobacco backstage and things like that, but they generally felt very good about this theater, and it had a very good name. Brigham Young took personal interest in the theater, down to walking around and checking out the saltwater dimmers and telling the ballerinas how long their skirts could or could not be, and there are several interesting stories that go along with that, but I'm not going to tell those stories here because our interest is a little different. At any rate, we began this big theater, and the big theater played for quite a long time and did very well. And in the dedicatory prayer, as I recall, it was Orson Pratt who gave the prayer, and he blessed everything, the nails, the plaster, the walls, the wood, the timbers, the lights, the people. I mean, he blessed every single speck of the theater. And one of the interesting things he said in the prayer was that if the theater ever fell into the hands of those who misused it, that it would be destroyed. And by George, along about the 1930s, a telephone company came in, and the theater had fallen on hard times, and it had gone through the vaudeville stage and was getting into some sleazy stuff, and it was torn down. And it was the site for it was the old is the telephone building down here on State Street, and there's still a plaque there to remind us of the greatness that it once had and doesn't anymore. Then there seems to be. And during that period, there was quite a lot of interest in the theater. I understand that there was an entire Shakespeare company, Irish Shakespeare Company, that was converted in Ireland and moved into southern Utah. And one of the things that Fred Adams talks about in his Utah Shakespeare Festival is that this company of Shakespeare people moved into southern Utah, and they produced Shakespeare in southern Utah long before they had running water and indoor plumbing and so forth, etc. So Shakespeare came across the plains, in the other hand, from the Bible, generally. A lot of people didn't even have the Book of Mormon, but they had the Bible and they had their Shakespeare, and by darn, that's enough for a lot of them. Then the church kind of entered, in my mind, entered into a period of corporate structure. And sort of became more interested in, and of course the Depression brought this on, the welfare of the saints. And arts somehow, and it seems to over a period of time, the arts took on a sort of a luxurious look, that was a luxury and not something you absolutely had to have. What people needed was housing and food, and that was all there was to that. And they needed the gospel. And that the other things were fine, and if you needed to be kept occupied, why, that was fine too. But it wasn't anything to be really taken terribly seriously. It was good to become acquainted with music and poetry in the theater, but it was not very important in terms of making a living, because everyone knew you couldn't make a living, in spite of the fact that we had had some Mormon stars. Maude Adams, for instance, was quite a big star in the United States, and there continued to be an occasional person who made it to some notoriety. And then we kind of lose sight of it until about the 1950s, when we surface with sort of Ward and Stake plays and the indomitable road shows. Now, let me take a parenthesis here and say that road shows, to my mind, have been dealt a very unfair blow. Every time someone wants to criticize any play that is written by or about Mormons, they say, it's a glorified road show. And I think that does the road show a great disservice, because in my mind, the road show is a piece of folk art. It is not a formal fine art system. It is folk art. And, I mean, where else would you go to find rhymed couplets written by a 12-year-old about ecology, spoken by a lawyer dressed in a papier-mâché pig outfit? I mean, it's really quite an amazing art form. And if taken in the place that it is meant to be, it is unpretentious, completely unpretentious. Road shows are unpretentious, except for an occasional person who is just dedicated to having the best road show in the world, and they whip their people to it, and oh, everybody's just so concerned, and they get up, and all of a sudden it's not any fun anymore. And although they may be full of lights and power and glory and the American flag and who knows what all, they miss the heart of the road show experience, which is half extemporaneous in the first place. And the very fact that these unpretentious pieces of folk art are compared to pretentious Mormon art forms is like comparing apples and oranges. They're both fruit, but they're different. And I think the road show has been dealt a bad blow by that, and I will defend road shows a lot. Although, you know, a certain part of me recoils in terror when I see one. On the other hand, I never come away feeling that I got anything but what was asked for. And in terms of some Mormon art, I would have to say that they publish a lot and produce a little. But at any rate, we had the road shows, and we had Stake and Ward plays occasionally. And we also had dance festivals, which, to my mind, was the beginning of the pageant. A dance festival, to my mind, was presented on purpose to have more people on the field and involved in the art than were watching it. And the more people were kept busy and off the streets, the better. And that generally sort of occurred. And they seemed to meet those things perfectly. And they actually rose to the point where they would rent football stadiums and have 2,000 dancers and 1,500 viewers. And in the case of Salt Lake, they actually had more than that. They would have 5,000 dancers and 10,000 watching, which was quite an amazing thing. But still, nonetheless, it was more of a pageant. And the legitimate theater still was on the basic level of whoever in the Ward or Stake really wanted to produce or present a play and could sell the Stake presidency or the bishop on it and didn't spend more than $10, that was fine. Then we come down, and BYU began to produce some original Mormon plays. They have all along, I guess, but they began to actually, under Harold Hansen, they began to actually make a concerted effort to write on Mormon themes. And of course, then came along our great and wonderful pageant at Cumorah, which I personally have never seen, and I can't really make any statements about it because I haven't seen it. And at some point, the church became gripped by what I call pageantitis. more and more people on the stage and more grandeur and more scripture and overlaid, well-modulated voices narrating for us the great events that happened in so-and-so, which is fine and wonderful, and it was a great missionary success. At least if you hear the people who are involved with it talking, it's a great missionary success. I don't actually know how many non-Mormons actually go to that. I've always been interested and wondered if someone would produce a study, but I'm afraid of what it might say, is that everyone comes from Arizona and Los Angeles to see the Hilcomora pageant, and we have mostly Mormons there who are patting each other on the back for their job well done. But at any rate, we had this pageantitis come down, and then somewhere in the early 60s, Carolyn Pearson started writing. Doug Stewart started writing, and a few other things happened at BYU which made people sit up and take a look. I remember my first brush with these things happened when I saw on the Era magazine, Dennis Smith, there was an article about Dennis Smith, who is a Mormon sculptor. And I remember thinking, you mean a person can actually be a Mormon artist? I'd never even thought about it before. And suddenly I realized that there was a whole art form that could be built, and maybe hadn't been, but could be, around a subculture, which I think we are. And it interested me. And then I went down to BYU and saw Carolyn's play about Orderville, The Order is Love. And it was a big success. And they put it on the DeYoung Concert Hall, and it was filled every night. And boy, everybody went running down there to see it. It was very exciting. And it was a pretty good play. And everybody felt that this was our heritage, you know. And, of course, in there I have to say that in 1948, one of our great workhorses, Promised Valley, was written. It was not actually written for the church. It was written for the state of Utah to celebrate the 100th anniversary of statehood. And it was written in a big hurry, I might add, by two very talented fellows, one a non-Mormon, and the other, the musician, was a Mormon. And that has served us, lo, these many years, as a representative of what the Mormon theater can be, and in many ways people think it is what it should be. It was a pageant. It was written as a pageant, and eventually the church liked the idea of the pageant so much that they bought the theater, the old Orpheum down here, I think the name of it was the Orpheum, and turned it into the Promised Valley Playhouse, where they took this outdoor phenomenon and put it indoors, which, to my mind, killed it. It didn't kill it in terms of people going to see it or people enjoying it, but artistically speaking, it was an outdoor play meant to be played outdoors, which was then played indoors, and they did not take whoever was in charge of it at that point, and I hate to point fingers, but I do not feel that they took the proper care to make it a clear change from outdoors to indoors. There's a great difference between an outdoor extravaganza and an indoor extravaganza, and they never did quite get the indoor part of it. It needed to be rewritten, I think. The authors are very cautious about that, and I don't particularly blame them. They've made a lot of money with it over the years. But it is an old piece. I mean, it is a 1948 piece and was produced in 1948. And many of the phrases and words, to my mind, of course, it won't come as a surprise to anyone who saw my version of Promised Valley, which played last summer, that I took out a lot of those old phrases and put in some new ones, and it caused some stress and strain with the playwrights, and they felt sort of bad about what I did, and I felt bad that they felt bad. But on the other hand, I was the director, and it was my job, so I did what I thought I had to do. Well, then came the wonderful era of the 70s, which produced our great ground gainer, and whatever you may think of it, Saturday's Warrior was the most potent play that has ever been produced in the church outside of Promised Valley. Promised Valley had in-house sanction and therefore went around the church just by the fact that it was sort of adopted by the church. Saturday's Warrior was the first commercial vehicle which actually gained the the imagination of the Mormon public at large, and farmers from Idaho Falls would take their 10 children, pile them all into a pickup, drive all the way to Spanish Fork, buy the tickets, stay overnight, see it, and feel well fed that they had seen it. Now, critically speaking, there are a lot of people who complain about Saturday's Warrior. I say, critically, that's a fine point of view to take, but its greatest contribution was not in the fact that it was either critically acclaimed or not. And we can still battle over whether it was a reasonable show or not, and people even hold it up now as the great and glorious road show, you know. The fact is that it's true, it may not have come up to some of the standards that people had for it. But on the other hand, what was it that caught people's imagination so much that you would hear people in church, the organist, all by themselves, without asking anybody, if you were listening to the music, which most people weren't, would be playing before church, da 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 da, and wondering, you know, they'd be looking around, seeing if anyone could recognize the tune. Which is, of course, who are these children coming down, the theme from Saturday's Warrior. People would get up and tearfully give talks about how it had changed their lives and quote passages from it that had been written. And it was pseudo-scripture for a while. And it traveled all over the church for quite a long time and made a whole lot of money for everyone involved. I mean, the people who owned the rights to it and the people who traveled with it. A lot of actors all of a sudden were working and earning money and traveling around and being seen, and technicians had work and directors had work, and people were excited, and books were published and t-shirts were printed, and my goodness, the dollar sign just took off. And what a thrill. And to me, that was important, because it proved to us that there was work out there and that people would come and see our wares. And so the next summer after Saturday's Warrior played, there were no less than 5 Mormon musicals about the preexistence and how everything was going to come about, and a poor lost soul who came back to the church and fraught with laughter and tears, and oh, you'll laugh, you'll cry, and please come and see our show. And most of them were terrible. But you see, everyone saw that it was possible, that there was not only something to be said, something to be taught, something to be gained, a way to use the talents, but, gee, we might even earn a living or a pittance, whatever, but earn something nonetheless, which had never been done before. So everybody got excited and wrote all these terrible plays, and I apologize if any of you wrote those plays, because they were good efforts. They truly were good efforts. And the fact that everyone felt they could go out and write a play and produce it was exciting. And for a while there, boy, the sparks were just shooting off in every direction, and everybody was excited. And, oh, it was turned into this wonderful, exciting time. Now, aside from that commercial side, we had an artistic side that was coming along. Orson Scott Card, Robert Elliott, and some other fine writers, Tom Rogers at BYU, wrote pieces which were critically acclaimed and never made it commercially, and are still talked about today as the finest examples of the Mormon art we have had. Fires of the Mind is constantly talked about as the finest Mormon play ever written, and may well be. These kinds of plays, Huebner by Tom Rogers, caused such distress among the general authorities that they closed it down, for heaven's sakes. What a wonderful thing to rouse the general authorities in such a manner. What it meant was that somebody was getting out there and saying something. It wasn't the mealy-mouthed niceness that we were used to. It wasn't selling the church selling the company line. It was taking a point of view that was totally different, and in some cases, highly controversial, from people who felt that, oh, our artists are getting out of hand, just like our historians. We've got to put the clamp on these people. We've got to be careful, because anybody in the public eye has power, and anybody who has power, of course, then is a force to be dealt with. And It isn't that these writers or these plays were actually detrimental to the church in any way, but they took on an entirely different point of view, which was critical and analytical and artistic as opposed to didactic. And it was a totally different way of approaching things, and it surprised everybody, and some people were thrilled and some people were horrified. And it was an interesting period. And along with that and the commercial theater that came along, all of a sudden we had the makings of just wonderful electricity going on. Well, I came along in that era and produced Here's Brother Brigham. I was trained professionally in San Francisco. The very same spring that I produced my one-man show, Here's Brother Brigham, BYU produced the grand musical pageant, Brigham, in the Marriott Center. To date, it has played 6 times, and I have played over 400. Now, I have played in much smaller houses, much smaller houses, but I am still going. To the chagrin of many, it did not turn out to be the story of Brigham Young, but indeed the story of Brigham Young University, which was again written by Arnold Sundegaard, who had written Promised Valley years before and was still a non-member. And it was just the same thing as having non-Mormons who have talent draw pictures for the church information buildings, just like and cut Mormon artists out of business when they are equally talented. General authorities seem to want to go outside the church for things, which is a situation which I do not understand. I mean, I think I understand it, but I don't think it's very worthwhile. I think we need to determine. They will say we need people of spirit to do what we're doing, and then they'll go right outside and find someone else to do it. And that doesn't mean that those people aren't talented, and it doesn't mean the Mormon people are more talented. I just think that they need to keep a close eye on who's in the flock as opposed to going outside the flock, because persons outside the flock seem to have more credibility. We will never get any credibility with our own flock if we don't tend the sheep that are here. Then in, 1976, Brother Packer gave a most interesting talk at BYU, which was titled "The Arts and the Spirit of the Lord," which just sent up sparks and fireworks everywhere. People either hated it or they loved it, but you could hardly find a person who didn't either hate it or love it. And one of the things that struck me in this talk, he said something akin to what President Kimball said. He said, "Go to then, you who are gifted, cultivate your gift, develop it in any of the arts and in every worthy example of them. If you have the ability and desire, seek a career or employ your talent as an avocation or cultivate it as a hobby. But in all ways, bless others with it. Set a standard of excellence. Employ it in the secular sense to every worthy advantage, but never use it profanely. Never express your gift unworthily. Increase our spiritual heritage in music, in art, in literature, in dance, in drama." Now that sounds like it goes right down the line with President Kimball. And it excited a lot of us. And it's interesting here that he says, increase our spiritual heritage. And that is what I believe we have today. We have a heritage. There are many people who talk about our theatrical tradition. We don't have a tradition. A tradition is something that comes down directly, in a direct line. The line of the priesthood is a tradition. Heritage is something we had back there, and we think wonderfully of it, and we don't have it anymore. We have a theatrical heritage. And we are now being stopped from creating a tradition by the next quote I will read from this same talk. If I can find it here. Very interesting to watch. "It is sad but true that almost as a rule, our most gifted members are drawn to the world." Now, that in itself is a bombshell kind of a statement. Why are they drawn to the world? Well, because they can't earn a living here. "They who are most capable to preserve our cultural heritage and extend it because of the enticements of the world seek rather to replace it. That is so easy to do because, for the most part, they do not have that intent. They think what they have to do is improve it. Unfortunately, many of them will live to learn that indeed, quote, many men struggle to climb to reach the top of the ladder only to find that it is leaning against the wrong wall, unquote. Now, what that says, of course, is that people go out of the church and labor so hard to build a reputation for themselves in the world that they lose sight of what the gospel is about and what their spiritual heritage is and so forth, etc. To those in my position, and there aren't very many of us anymore, who have carefully made sure and gone back and back and back to the wall and made sure we put a big X on the wall to make sure it is the correct wall, and have built up our ladder against that wall only to get three-quarters the way up and find that the wall has moved. And that is basically what I'm going to talk about today, because, I mean, we've now reached the present day, because what has happened in the last 5 years is negligible because of this. In the Church Priesthood Bulletin, September 1981, number 15, the first general announcement. Touring and performing groups. An increasing number of touring and performing groups, directly or indirectly associated with church organizations, are attempting to schedule tours to various parts of the world. Some of these groups apparently are soliciting support from priesthood leaders and members in the areas they would like to visit. Occasionally, they ask members to arrange housing and other accommodations for them. Touring and performing groups should not solicit support and tour accommodations from priesthood leaders and members. Local leaders should feel no obligation to respond to such requests. Well, now that is just general enough to not let us know who they are talking about or what exactly they want from us. And at that time, in 1981, there were a number of traveling touring companies or companies trying to gear up to tour. I myself was one of them. And when that church announcement came out, every ward, stake, region that I began to contact pointed to that and said, we are not to help you. And I said, well, I'm really not asking for any help. I just want to let you know that I'm coming. We cannot help you. Okay, well, I'm going to be in Seattle. Don't even tell me. I don't want to know. Oh, well, how can I let your members know? You can't. Oh, well, what should I do to let them know? It's none of our business. And this began happening all over the church. Aside from an occasional maverick stake president who said, my people need theatricals, and they will have them, and I will see to it that they have them, and I don't care what anybody says. I'm going to go against church policy. Well, now let me read this policy to you again. It doesn't say that. A number of touring and performing groups, directly or indirectly associated with church organizations, are attempting to schedule tours to various parts of the world. Fine, nothing wrong with that. Some of these groups apparently are soliciting support from priesthood leaders and members in the areas they would like to visit. Well, that's true. How can you put on a show without support from somebody? Support means they come to see the show, right? Okay. Occasionally, they ask members to arrange housing or other accommodations for them. All the professional companies I knew did not do that. There was the Thummond String Cymbal Band from Chattanooga, Tennessee, that wanted to come to Salt Lake and tried to do that all the way across, but the professional companies did not do that. Touring and performing groups should not solicit support and tour accommodations from priesthood leaders and members. Local leaders should feel no obligation. Now, that's the line right there. Should feel no obligation to respond to such requests. Request for what? Well, it was sufficiently general that it looked to me like, and to most everybody else like, they didn't want us going out there to tour. And the general authorities felt that. Well, finally that kind of blew over for a while, and we started to travel again. And then in February 1982... Bulletin number 20 came out, and as the second one, the second note here, this was the death knell. It said, protecting the tax-exempt status of church property in the U.S. and Canada. The following is a reaffirmation of current policy. Meeting houses are not to be used for any purpose other than worship, religious training, or programmed activities relating to the church. They should not be rented or leased to any individual, company, or organization for commercial purposes. That includes organ lessons, etc. Dance instructors, music teachers, and others who give non-religious instruction are paid by class participants should not be allowed to use the facilities. Meeting houses may not be used by local units to raise funds by making or selling goods on a regular or ongoing basis, sponsoring the sale of commercial items. Many activities not only have consumer liability, but also have income, sales, use, excise, and property tax implications. Such activities include entertainment for which admission is charged and for which performers are paid for their services. Listen to this one. Parentheses. Payment of travel expenses is not payment for services rendered. All right. Now, that right there is damaging, but it goes on, folks. Fundraising activities should not be held only for persons living within the boundaries of the sponsoring unit, and there should be no advertisement or solicitation to the general public. Do not post commercial advertisements in meeting houses. And that's the end of it. Now, I did learn by some investigation, but that last piece about don't putting commercial advertisements in the meeting houses, no plant. In other words, the people who said, don't mess up the church. We don't want to have a lot of messy advertisements on the board, although there can be a case made that, you know, you shouldn't advertise in the church. Well, what that did was say to people, okay, we can't hire in Here's Brother Brigham anymore to play in our water stake, which is essentially, it's like hiring in a band. Somehow they say, well, you can have a dance and you can hire in a band and they get paid for their services, but we can't hire in a play. Well, actually, if you read this carefully, you can hire in a play. You can hire in a play as long as you don't charge admission for it, and as long as it is for the ward members only and you don't advertise it openly. Now, most places that I go to do Here's Brother Brigham anymore, I don't play in wards or stakes anyway. And I'm very careful to tell people that they need, to, if the water stake is going to sponsor it, what they need to do. And if it is fundraising or anything of that nature, they need to go out and rent a theater, and then I will come there and play, and we can make any kind of arrangements from there. But, of course, when people saw that, and coupled with the prior piece, they said, the church doesn't like these commercial programs, period. That's it. Well, I was president of ALMA, the Association of Latter-day Media Artists at that time, and we went up to the church and met with President Tanner and President Hinckley and Gene Larson and lots of people who were supposedly in charge of all these things, and we even wrote a very carefully worded letter to the 12 apostles and asked them to consider the fact that they were killing the touring of Mormon theatricals. No matter how good or bad they were killing it, and that it would be the death knell of the theater in the 80s. And as all things happen in the church, they went into a closed-door session, met on it, and came out and said, we don't feel like we need to change anything. We feel like this is the proper guideline, and boy, we sure do love you, brother. Go right out there and do the best you can, and we sure love you. No, it can't play in the church, but we sure love you, and we hope all will go well with you, and all will be well with you. No, we can't help you. But boy, we hope you go out there and produce your little heart out, and we want the greatest masterpieces anybody has ever seen, and we want them to be in the movie theaters and the theatricals all across the country, but don't advertise in the church that they're playing. And on and on and on. And it was very discouraging. It was highly discouraging. And we went back and petitioned them humbly what we should do, that they, as the general authorities, all we were asking, and very humbly too, I might add, was that they give us some direction, some help as to how we could go about doing what they had asked us to do without building our ladder against the wrong wall. And they came out with the next bulletin, which was in September 1981. Whoops, came after the other bulletin, I see here. But at any rate, it did appear in the general in the New Era, and it said, an increasing number of touring and performing groups directly or indirectly associated with the church organizations. Oops, I already read that one. Excuse me. No wonder I got mixed up. This was November 1982. This was after everything had happened. This is number 29, Priesthood Bulletin. And it was also published in the Church News. Wholesome Entertainment. Oh, you don't think that's a good title? I think that's a great title for what this says. Church members should seek out wholesome, appropriate entertainment. Such entertainment may include that which is provided by professional performing artists or theatrical groups who uphold church standards of morality and decency. Performers who provide wholesome entertainment in accordance with church standards should be encouraged and patronized. If you can find out where they're playing. We don't want to tell you which ones, and we don't want to give you too much hope about this, but if you can find them, we sure hope you go to them. So, the current state of the theater in the 80s is exit stage left, which means that the theater exited and the stage is left. We conscientiously build little stages into every ward house in the church. And we conscientiously avoid any opportunity to expand upon our talents in doing this. Ward and stake plays have become something of an anomaly. BYU processes thousands of young hopefuls who are then directed to go to Los Angeles and do their best because there's no work for them here. Promised Valley Playhouse can accommodate very few directors and very few actors, and has not drawn, at least up to this point, and they're trying to make a change, but has not drawn fine artists in terms of acting or directing. And the church, it's very unclear what is happening in the church right now, because there are lots of rumors that they want to sell the theater because they don't understand why they own the theater in the first place. They own the theater in the first place, I assume, to sort of produce works for Mormon people, and there were a great number that came out under Ralph Rogers. Some were great big pageants and some were smaller pieces, but pieces did get produced and did get printed and were used around the church. That does not seem to be what they are doing now, and what they're trying to do now is upgrade the standard of the pieces that are done there, that it is not a summer camp for young theatrical hopefuls or people whose parents don't know how to use them in any other way and they send them down there to be in a chorus. They are trying very hard to upgrade the kind of artistic work that is done there. It is noticeably hard. The theater-going populace of Salt Lake City is sharply polarized, and most people, including a number of general authorities, interestingly enough, would not be caught dead at the Promised Valley Playhouse, whatever is playing there. They won't tell you that, but it is very clear that most of them hold honorary chairs and seats at up at the University of Utah and will not deign to go down to see the Promised Valley Playhouse productions. I'm not telling you that that is good or bad. I'm just saying that that is a reality, and that most people regard the University of Utah Theater as the only true professional theater in Utah, and most people think it's much too far to drive to Provo to see anything down there than to drive up to the U, which is certainly true, but I have noticed that the distance between here and Provo is greater than the distance between Provo and here. however, that actually happens. What is the future? Well, who can say? It may be that the Lord is trying to say to us, brethren, it is time that you branch out into the world. It is time that you use your talents to gain some notoriety in the world so that then the church will run out and use you, like they, for instance, did with the Osmonds. If Lucas and Lucasfilms or Steven Spielberg were members of the church, you can bet that the church would be making grand and wonderful epics on film to produce commercially across the land. Unfortunately, they are not, and those films are not being made. We haven't managed to get anyone on the Broadway stage for quite a while who would admit he was a Mormon. Robert Peterson came back and is currently employed by the University of Utah as a professor. And while that is an admirable profession, and I have nothing against that, he has the tiger by the tail in Utah and is one of the few people earning his living in the theater, and along with me and a few other people are trying to keep the theater tradition alive. He is much more known as a professor or as an actor rather than a writer or a producer or director. And here's where we get to the big problem, which is the analysis of this situation. How do we get out of this vicious circle? We are producing technicians and talented directors and actors all the time. They may be young, but they're talented and they're young lions and they have a lot to give. We have production capabilities. We have technicians who can design, put together truck, light, and put together all the technical facets, the sound, the lights, the costumes, the makeup, the wigs, everything that a production demands. We have those people in the church. We have them working both professionally and working as teachers who are willing to go out and do wonderful, marvelous things. So we have the talented people artistically. We have the talented people in the technical area. We have writers who, we have a few writers who are talented who aren't writing. And the reason they aren't writing is because they don't know if they can get their works produced. Promise Valley Playhouse has only recently begun to do original pieces, and the original pieces they are doing are non-Mormon pieces, The Hound of the Baskervilles, The Snow Queen, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, things like that, that they will take from books and rework, but they are not Mormon pieces. Mormon writers and playwrights have no vehicle for which they can have their works produced, except in the case of someone like Lex de Azevedo, who put up all his own money or went to people and had a big enough name that people put money into a project, and he produced Charlie, which is the only thing that has been done in quite a long time, and it died on the road for various and sundry reasons. And the road is where we make our money. So the problem is the writer doesn't see that he's going to get anything out of what he's writing. He may write something that is absolutely superb and may actually be the masterpiece that President Kimball and Brother Packer are talking about, but it will never be seen because no one is producing it. BYU, outside of BYU, Ricks College, and the Promise Valley Playhouse, no one else is producing Mormon pieces. And in order to get into those places, you have to know someone, you have to be very fanciful, and you have to be there at just the right time with the right message and the right smile on your face and the right handshake, and then you get in. In terms of my own experience, I have found that once you do get in, and if it's successful, then you don't need to count on getting in again, even if it was successful, because they don't want to show favoritism towards an artist who might produce something that really is available, like here's Brother Brigham, for instance, which continues to be well acclaimed by the audiences that see it and by the critics who see it, both Mormon and non-Mormon, but they think they've played it too much at BYU, and even though there are new generations coming every year, they feel that it's a disservice to their own students to show one show more than once or twice in a certain period of time. So there are many political problems involved, and I go back to the fact that the producers are not available. And the producers are not available because they don't see a way to get a return on their money because of these little bulletins that went out and killed the road. Now, that is a line of logic which I hope will hold up under analysis, but in my way of thinking, until the church can find a way to create an environment of support in the church, if one general authority would get up in conference and quote a line from a play, the play could run all over the church. Probably. That's exactly the reason they don't do it. Aside from the fact that they probably haven't read the play because they don't have time. It is a thorny problem, and it is one that is not easily fixed or remedied. I don't know how to fix this. We are now in a position where our artists have to go to the world because they have no other choice. And as I say, I am one of the few artists in this area who actually lives and works here and makes his money here, and the only reason I know that I can do that is because I pay my tithing and wait for the phone to ring, because I can't call up the church and have them help me very much. What the future holds, I really don't know. I know that right now, in the 80s, the touring circuit is dead, and the people in Oklahoma City, in Minneapolis, and in Florida, and in Boston, and all around the country who would love to see some of these shows, even the old standbys, would love to see a touring Promise Valley, for heaven's sakes, which is very safe under everybody's estimate, will never see it. Unless the ward or stake has an especially visionary man at the top of it who can say, our people need this, and we will produce it because of what it says, not because we're trying to get them off the streets, because that is not a good reason to produce a theater piece, although it does happen to work. That is my spiel. I would like to ask you if you have some questions. I'm sure that you have some questions about this. You should know that these are highly opinionated opinions, and they're my own opinions based on my own experience as I have lived through it and now know the reality of the situation. There are a great number of plays that are in my heart that I would like to write, but I see no reason to write them when I don't see any way to get them produced. Some of them are highly artistic, others of them are more commercial. Our writers would probably like to write if they felt like they could have a way of doing it. And where the producers are, they're, as far as I know, they're putting their money in land at the moment. So, Paul. Maybe foolhardiness. It depends on which road you're talking from. The essence. Hard to give a memo to him. Yeah. Yes, there is. I believe there's a connection between what I would consider to be what some call, I don't call it that, the creeping bureaucracy, which has taken over the corporate area of the church, and they are so busy, and rightfully so, I suppose, administering to the church as a whole, and to the many wants and needs and difficulties involved in running a large business like this, without worrying about the five of us who can produce pieces that can actually do the conversion process for them. There, at the moment, the church is involved in quantity missionarying as opposed to quality missionarying, which, if we had one good film, just one good film, it would do the work of thousands of missionaries, hundreds of thousands of missionaries, because you could use it over and over and over again. And, of course, the few films that we have that are reasonably well done are used just in exactly that capacity. To me, and you know, and again, it's only a personal opinion, I think that people are too busy to think about it, and that the artist sees the possibility, and he works toward that, but I think they wait for it to have already happened before they incorporate it into the memos and the up and down stream of paperwork that happens, and I don't see any real way of curing that at the moment. They won't. I don't think they ever will. Oh, there's plenty of drama, but you see, it's so involved in the theocratic end, in the religious end, that you have to do a lot of explaining to get there. And I think that the topic is just far too, at least for today's cinema, it is far too serious and complicated a matter for Hollywood to be interested in. Now, if we have a talented screenwriter who comes along and is able to melt it down into essential nuts and bolts and create a dramatic scenario without attempting to pump the didactic juices all the time, which is what we are wont to do, and simply can tell the story, we may actually be able to eventually do that. But I have really no hope that Hollywood will ever come around to it. See, Brigham Young was enough of a great American leader that they could justify that. Joseph Smith, except for his day, is all but forgotten today, except for those of us who continually remember him. And though the period was full of drama and excitement, the play has yet to be written that can write Joseph Smith correctly, because the casting of it is impossible. It's like casting Christ. And finally they said, okay, we won't show Christ. We'll have him around all the time. Which is what some of the artists finally did and said, we're not even going to attempt to show what he looked like. And every time you see a movie on Christ, you say, gosh, that doesn't look like what I thought he would look like. He has teeth. He smiles. You know, he bleeds, he cries, he does things that Christ, well, yeah, we cried, yeah, but he smiled. He played ball. I mean, I don't know what to... Did you see Jesus of Nazareth, that opening sequence where they were playing that rag ball game? Oh, it just absolutely knocked you out. It was Zeffirelli who did that. You know, he had a lot of... But still, there were people who complained. And this recent Brigham Young, that was done by the guy who ripped us off here in Utah. He cast a guy as Joseph Smith that was a big, tall, gawking, dark, raven-looking man who looked somewhat like you would think a non-Mormon would think a prophet looks like, sort of off in the wilderness most of the time and sort of explosive and exciting, but not nice. And people came out of Brigham, that movie, and the first thing they invariably said was, "Did you like the Joseph Smith?" "Oh, I didn't like him." It wasn't about... the movie wasn't about Joseph Smith, it was about Brigham Young. But the immediate reaction of everyone was, "Did you like the Joseph Smith?" I didn't hear anybody that didn't, sooner or later, and most of them sooner, dislike the casting of Joseph Smith because he wasn't warm and loving and sweet and wiped the dirt off little children's shoes like we all know he did. So, and we have been told in our apocryphal stories. So the casting of Joseph Smith is almost impossible, and it will never satisfy the church. I am satisfied that the church would react to a story about Joseph Smith the same as the, was it the Mennonites or the Amish did about Witness. Now, as far as I felt, I came away from Witness feeling really good about the Amish, saying, "Hey, there's some people to admire, and though they have some unusual beliefs, boy, they're great people, and I can love them. And they're lovable, and they're sweet, and they're kind, and they're good." And the Amish said, "No, no, that's all wrong. We aren't that way. That's terrible. You know, you've completely misportrayed it. You shouldn't..." "Oh, no. Oh, it's terrible." And you can imagine a story by Hollywood about Joseph Smith, which certainly would get into some of the most tender areas of Joseph Smith's life, and the church would deny, deny, deny. And, of course, all the church members would run to see it, you know, because it wouldn't publish the party line. So I see that my time is up. People are coming in here and obviously not to hear me. Thank you very much for your attention.